To 2 Samuel chapter 17, a couple of long chapters tonight, so buckle up. Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Let me choose 12,000 men. And I'll arise and pursue David tonight. And I'll come upon him while he is weary and discouraged and throw him into a panic, and all the people who are with him will flee. I'll strike down only the king, and I'll bring back all the people to you as a bride comes back to her husband. You seek the life of only one man, and all the people will be at peace." And the advice seemed right in the eyes of Absalom and all the elders of Israel. And Absalom said, "Call Hushai the Archite also, and let's hear what he has to say." When Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom said to him, "Thus has Ahithophel spoken. Shall we do as he says? If not, you speak." And then Hushai said to Absalom, "This time the counsel that Ahithophel has given you is not good." Hushai said, "You know that your father and his men are mighty men, and that they are enraged like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. Besides, your father is an expert in war, and he will not spend the night with the people. Behold, even now he's hidden himself in one of the pits or in some other place. And as soon as some of the people fall at the first attack, whoever hears of it will say, 'There has been a slaughter amongst the people who follow Absalom.' Then even the valiant men, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will utterly melt with fear. For all of Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and that those who are with him are valiant men. But my counsel is that all Israel be gathered to you, from Dan to Beersheba, as the sand by the sea for a multitude, and that you go to battle in person. So we shall come upon him in some high place where he is to be found, and we shall light upon him as the dew falls on the ground, and of him and all the men with him, not one will be left. And if he withdraws into the city, then all Israel will bring ropes to that city, and we shall drag it into the valley until not even a pebble is to be found there." And Absalom and the men of Israel said, "The counsel of the Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. For the Lord has ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel, so the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom." Then Hushai said to Zadok and Abathar the priests, "Thus and so did Ahithophel counsel Absalom and the elders of Israel, and thus and so I have also counseled. Now therefore send quickly and tell David, 'Do not stay tonight at the fords of the wilderness, but by all means pass over, lest the king and all the people who are with him be swallowed up.' Now Jonathan and Ahimaaz were waiting at Enrogel. A female servant was to go and tell them, and then they would go and tell King David, for they were not to be seen entering the city. But a young man saw them and told Absalom. So both of them went away quickly, came to the house of the man in Bahurim, who had a well in his courtyard, and they went down into it. And the women took and spread a covering over the well's mouth and scattered grain on it, and nothing was known of it. When Absalom's servants came to the women at the house, they said, 'Where is Ahimaaz and Jonathan?' And the women said to them, 'What?'" No, they didn't say that. "They have gone over the brook of water. And when they have sought and could not find them, they returned to Jerusalem." After they'd gone, the men came up out of the well and went and told King David. And they said to David, "Arise and go quickly over the water, for thus and so has Ahithophel counseled against you." And David arose and all the people who were with him, and they crossed over the Jordan. By daybreak, not one was left who had not crossed the Jordan. When Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his donkey, went off home to his own city. He set his house in order and hanged himself. And he died and was buried in the tomb of his father. Then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed the Jordan with all the people of Israel. Now Absalom had sent Amasa over the army instead of Joab. Amasa was the son of a man named Ithra the Ishmaelite, who had married Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, sister of Zeruah, Joab's mother. And Israel and Absalom encamped in the land of Gilead. When David came to Mahanaim, Shobai, the son of Nahash from Rabbah, there will be a test on this, guys, just so you of the Ammonites, and Machir, the son of Amiel of Lo-Debar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite from Rogalim, I'm pronouncing every one of these correct, so you know that, brought beds, basins, earthen vessels, wheat, barley, flour, parched grain, beans and lentils, honey, curds, and sheep, and cheese from the herd for David and the people with him to eat. And they said, the people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. And then David mustered the men who were with him. They set over their commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. And David sent out the army, one-third under the command of Joab, one-third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, and Joab's brother, and one-third under the command of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said to the men, I myself will also go out with you. But the men said, you shall not go. For if we flee, they will not care about us. If half of us die, they will not care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, it is better that you send us help from the city. The king said to them, whatever seems the best to you, I will do. So the king stood at the side of the gate while all the army marched out by the hundreds and by the thousands. And the king ordered Joab and Abishai and Ittai, deal gently for my sake with this young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave orders to all commanders about Absalom. So the army went into the field against Israel, and the battle was fought in the forest of Ephraim. And the men of Israel were defeated there by the servants of David. And the loss there was great on that day, 20,000 men. The battle spread over the face of all the country, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword. And Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak and was suspended between the heaven and the earth while the mule that was under him went on. Now, mind you, if you're reading another version, it's a little clear in the other versions that he got caught by his hair. Remember he was pretty boy with the long hair? Okay. He's stuck in a tree now, hanging by his hair. And a certain man saw it and told Joab, behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak. Joab said to the man who told him, why, you saw him? Why then did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have been glad to give you 10 pieces of silver and a belt. Okay. But the man said to Joab, even if I felt in my hand the weight of 1,000 pieces of silver, I would not reach out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, for my sake, protect the young man Absalom. On the other hand, if he had dealt treacherously against his life, and there is nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof. Joab said, I'll not waste time like this with you. And he took 3 javelins in his hand, thrust them into the heart of Absalom while he was still alive in the oak. And 10 young men, Joab's armor bearers, surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him. And Joab blew the trumpet, and troops came back from pursuing Israel, for Joab restrained them. And they took Absalom and threw him into a great pit in the forest and raised over him a great heap of stones. And all Israel fled, everyone to his own home. Now Absalom, in his lifetime, had taken and set up for himself the pillar that is in the king's valley. And he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. He called the pillar after his own name, and it is called Absalom's monument to this day. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, let me run and carry the news to the king that the Lord has delivered him from the hands of the enemies. And Joab said to him, you are not to carry the news today. You may carry news another day, but today you shall carry no news because the king's son is dead. And then Joab said to the Cushite, go tell the king what you've seen. And the Cushite bowed before Joab and he ran. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said again to Joab, come what may, let me also run after the Cushite. And Joab said, what will you run, my son, seeing that you have no reward for the news? Come what may, he said, I will run. So he said to him, run. Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and outran the Cushite. Now David was sitting between the 2 gates, and the watchman went up to the roof of the gate by the wall, and when he lifted up his eyes and he looked, he saw a man running alone. The watchman called out and told the king, and the king said, if he's alone, there is news in his mouth. And he drew nearer and nearer. The watchman saw another man running. And the watchman called to the gate and said, see, another man's running alone. And the king said, he also brings news. The watchman said, I think the running of the first is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. And the king said, he's a good man. He comes with good news. Then Ahimaaz cried out to the king, all is well. And he bowed before the king with his face to the earth and said, blessed be the Lord your God who has delivered up the men who raised their hands against the Lord the king. And the king said, is it well with the young man Absalom? And Ahimaaz answered, When Joab sent the king's servant, your servant, I saw a great commotion, but I do not know what it was. And the king said, turn aside and stand here. So he turned aside and stood still. And behold, the Cushite came. The Cushite said, good news from my lord the king, for the Lord has delivered you this day from the hand of all those who rose up against you. The king said to the Cushite, is it well with the young man Absalom? And the Cushite answered, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be like that young man. And the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate, and he wept. And as he went, he said, oh, my son Absalom, would I have died instead of you? Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1 says this, the Spirit explicitly says that in the latter times some will fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons. I read it again. The Spirit explicitly says that in latter times, some will fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons. To much degree, that is the world that we are living in today. That's the reality of this culture and this society that we live in. The reality is this evening is there's always going to be those people out there in the world that we live in who will lie to you and will manipulate you in order to see their own personal agenda furthered. They will do so to confirm and to secure their own heart in the position that they have taken. In other words, if they lie to you and convince you and pull you in, then that solidifies them and makes them feel better about where they stand. It is absolutely true that misery does love company. So when we as believers, as disciples, if you will, when we grow in knowledge, when we grow up in discernment, we can learn to recognize and expose these kind of tactics. Much of the seductiveness of such lies tends to come from the fact that they always tend to contain at least a kernel of truth. Okay? You're sad, aren't you? He whispers. God wants you to be happy, so fill in the blank. Can you believe what that guy did to you? I mean, God doesn't expect you to be a doormat, does he? You know, that church is just too rough. God is loving and he's gracious and he's merciful. I don't see why they always need to be pushing you. And the list goes on and on. Pieces of truth, crumbs of reality. But the rest is exaggeration, is extrapolation, and is imagination. And it usually goes on right out here in our heads. Soon, a supposed truth is ringing in our head, and what happens next is you lose sight of the real truth. And then what happens is your rights then begin to trump everything. And having begun the day as a follower, a faithful follower, you end it in the weeds. Paul, he dealt with this even in the early church. He was so exasperated by the people in the church in Galatia. He said this, he goes, O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you that you should not obey the truth? Are you so foolish? Having begun in the Spirit, are you now being made perfect by the flesh? Galatians 3:1. You see, what happened in the church in that time, really, in many aspects, is no different than us today, because many of the people there were falling for this trick of the devil. Truth mingled with falsehood. So in our account here today, this evening, 2 Samuel 17 and 18 here, we see what appears to be everybody in two chapters, everybody trying to manipulate everybody else. It seemed in these two chapters that everybody had an agenda. That's much like the world that we live in today. It seems everyone has an agenda, and it's really, really hard to get to the truth. You see, the question here, that which separates the sheep from the goats, and still does today, is what is those people's motivation? What is our motivation? What is the people who are speaking to you each day? What is their motivation? And you know, the thing is, motivation's a really funny thing. Because motivation, we sometimes fail to see it, you know, even when it's riding in the passenger seat right beside us. Motivation can range from pride to anger to power to retribution to pleasure, and the list goes on. The driving elements can be so many, but they all have a couple of things in common. One is the idea of my rights. Welcome to 2019. You can't do that to me. I have my rights. And of course, such a statement is extremely and overtly worldly. And there is seemingly not a trace of Jesus in there anywhere when we say such things. So it's totally of the world, but we will still draw and shoot that gun when we believe we've been unrighteously taken advantage of. You can't do that to me. I have my rights. Another, number two in this, is driven by what we think we deserve. I deserve to be happy. I deserve this fleshly indulgence. I deserve to have this, to experience this. I deserve this. Or, hey, I don't deserve to be treated that way. I don't deserve that kind of treatment, those harsh words, that kind of denial. I don't deserve that. So often we go, that's not fair. And I, you know, there's the battle cry of our generation. That's not fair. Listen, pride is an incredibly, wickedly blinding enemy. They both have one thing in common, and so we can boil it down to this final little element. Me. Me. When decisions and viewpoints and pursuits and directions, when they are motivated by the almighty me, then we are on the road of eventual pain and destruction. And along the way, I can promise you a lot of loneliness and a lot of emptiness and a lot of broken heart. It's interesting that it's been repeatedly shown that one of the greatest medicines for depression, to get your eyes off of you and onto others, is just other-centeredness. Remember a few years back, and it was a scientific poll. It wasn't something done by any church, but they did a survey of people that was in paid counseling with shrinks, medication, all the rest for depression over here. And then they had these other groups that was just going and talking to a friend. Guess which one said that they felt the best and had the better comeback from? Just the free friend. So, you know, if you bought them coffee, you're still coming out way ahead. We need to learn to serve others, love others, be thankful for our lives. It's one of the biggest problems we have today is we're just not thankful. And I've said it before, I say it again, it's one of the reasons why I love taking you on missions trips, because it's good for you to go out there. You know what? You're likely to come back from one of our missions trips and you're going to feel a whole lot better. You're going to realize how good we have it here. In the case of David, when it came time to go to battle, same deal, people talking to him, telling him things. I mean, I want you to notice he stood down on the insistence of these trusted men around him. Now, mind you, he was king. He was the king. He could have said, hey, guys, You don't get to talk to me like that. I don't deserve that. I'm the king. But you see, their reasoning was sound. And thus, despite the fact that, hey, going to battle, that was David's thing, right? That was his forte. He did not go out with everybody here. He might have appeared or worried that he would appear to be a coward. That's such a strong motivator in and to itself, what we think people are going to think about us. He might have been accused of being a coward. He might have felt like he was slighted or marginalized or somehow disrespected because these guys didn't want him to go to battle with him. I mean, again, he was the king, but he didn't. He didn't let his emotions and his imaginations get the better of him here. Why? Because he knew those men could be trusted. And they knew they could be trusted because they had earned that trust over a long period of time. It wasn't like these guys just got off the boat. They had proven themselves in the lives of David, in the life of David. So all there had been, no doubt, previous testings where the outcome, you know, wasn't life or death like this one was. And they'd proven themselves to be righteous and other-centered and faithful in the decisions and in the relationships with David. So when it came time that they had to throw down with David and say, dude, I know you're king, but no, you're not going out. He listened. That's the way God does with us, first of all. I'll put God here in the center for a minute. I mean, he has always dealt with us that way, and he deals with all of us as a group that way. He says, you know, you can look the likes of Luke 16:10, Deuteronomy 8:2. He always tells us that he tests us in the small things before he entrusts us with the bigger things. You know, we want the big stuff, you know. Well, we want the, you know, the badge. We want the star. And yet we've not proven ourselves in the small things. Now, the end of this story, chapter 18, it's seemingly the end of all such stories. Maybe they don't all end in violent death, although many have and many do. And I guess I have lived long enough and been in the ministry long enough that I have watched some of these people it hasn't ended well. That's all I can say. But in the end, for sure, overt pride, arrogance, self-centered worldview, it inevitably ends badly. When these things are in control of our lives, we do not win. Because inevitably, the me first, c'est la vie kind of approach to life, and we think we can live that way. But the problem is, it's most certainly going to clash with the next guy's me first, c'est la vie approach to life. And if you've ever seen the results of a head-on collision, you can imagine what the outcome is going to be. It's not pretty. So for Absalom to die in such a manner, many would say was ironic, but it really wasn't at all. In fact, the truth was it was unavoidable and it was inescapable. He simply was on that road to ruin. And that road only had one ending. One of the problems of the culture and the society that we live in today, and certainly our younger generation, is the inability to extrapolate. And I read just recently a big old monster book by Oz Guinness about this very thing. That they will say, I believe A, and that's going to lead me to B. Okay. But then now B will lead you to C, right?
Well, wait, what?
And then C, where does that go? D, and then, of course, you know, E, F, G, right? And so end up G. And they look at you like you just hit them with a baseball bat. It's like, well, where did you think B was going to take you? B doesn't stop. And so we fail to realize the decisions we make, the moves we make, it goes on. A leads to B, leads to C, leads to D. So we have the inability to extrapolate because we're unwilling to look beyond. We live in a fantasy life. Of course, again, the younger generation today is telling you that you can do anything. You know, and they wave the flags and the fireworks go out and, you know, you're a brave new generation. You can do anything. And that's a lie because you can't. You can't. Some of you don't have the talent. Some of you don't have the ability. Some of you don't have the gift. Some of you don't have the money. Some of you don't have whatever it might be. That's not, I'm not beating on you. I'm not shaming you with that idea, but that's just the reality. What can you do? You can do what you were born to do. That's what you can do. That's what you're supposed to do. I mean, there's a lot of things that I can't do, and a lot of them I just simply don't want to do. Do you ever see that guy who does all that free climbing? I mean, his knuckles, you know, look like my legs, you know, from climbing. And he's just crazy. He just chalks up and he just climbs these cliffs, free climbing, does things. It's like, oh, no. You know, and he will die. He's going to fall. He's going to die. It's just inevitable. And it's like, I'm not going up there. And then I see these guys, and oh, next year we're taking people off into space. I'm not, no. I'm staying on this planet until my exit from this planet is right to Jesus. There will be no in between, okay? I don't care to ever see the moon. I'm not leaving. And so we get these ideas. What are we called to do? That's what you need to figure out. And it goes back to Sunday's message again. Now, before we go to small groups, I need to say this to you. Now, the truth is in this two chapters, the truth is in all of this, since all the way back to Absalom, you know, dealing with his sister's rape. The truth is Absalom never had a chance. All of this hoopla, it might have looked good. It might have been an exercise in showmanship, and Absalom may have been handsome and talented and a smoozer, and he was all of those things. But none of it would have ever made any difference because God quite openly chose David. Do you understand that tonight? David was God's choice. So whether we agree or whether we understand, David was God's choice. Therefore, it was essentially over for Absalom before it began. Now, let me point out that God did indeed use these events to teach David some life lessons, and we'll see that as David's life goes on here, because God uses everything. But the outcome was predetermined. God had spoken. Now he's saying, so God doomed Absalom? No, I'm saying Absalom made a left turn and the rest was written. That was it. Absalom didn't need to die, but he wasn't going to be king. He was never going to be king. God has a plan.